You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Robin Pogrebin. Robin, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Robin, you're the reporter at the Culture Desk at the Times, and I'm interested in a lot of what you've written about the arts, but you've also co-authored the book, The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, An Investigation. So though I wanted to talk primarily about the arts, I feel like we have to talk a little bit about that book because he is an aspect of what's happening in 2020, as well as in a different world, so many of your articles for the Times about culture and museums and art. So to begin a little bit with that, with a book, The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, An Investigation, that you co-wrote, can you tell me a little bit about that? Or, you know, it seems at once it's this kind of portrayal that outlines what a mistake was made with his appointment. And I kind of wish your book was written before that, but that couldn't have happened or may not have made a difference. What do you think now that the book is out? What's your comment on what's happening? It's such a kind of, it seems like, you know, we're moving in such a kind of upsetting direction. And that book was a push to kind of write that direction or get information out there, as I see it, in this kind of, as it's been called, post-fact environment or post-truth environment. How do you feel?
Actually, I would say that, you know, what motivated the book for me as well as my co-author was an effort to try to get it some more facts and more of the truth, given that we felt that so much of the hearings as they were occurring were obscured by basically people's preconceptions, the assumptions that people on both sides of the political spectrum brought to those events, which were essentially seeing what they wanted to see, that the Kavanaugh hearings were something of kind of a Rorschach test, and spoke to this period we're living in, which is so polarized, in which people aren't really listening to one another and kind of trying to get to the bottom of things, but in fact are bringing to a set of circumstances their own political predilections. And, you know, on the one hand, you had Brett Kavanaugh portrayed as kind of the epitome of white male privilege, and someone who symbolized, you know, Me Too kind of run amok, ways in which people hadn't been held accountable. On the other hand, you had the narrative that this was a guy who'd been falsely accused, and imagine if it was your brother or husband or father. And we really tried to look and kind of interrogate his background and understand who he was from kind of childhood up to the point at which we all met him as a country, and to really see whether or not there was a pattern of behavior that affirms the experience of Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez, who was his Yale classmate, or not. And you know, ultimately, I think we disappointed both camps, because we didn't fully exonerate him, but we also didn't kind of fully kind of convict him either of either. And I think what we really tried to do was uncover as much information as there was out there about his history, and also to just explore the idea that at this point there was no room for nuance or a gray area, that the people were going to see which extreme they wanted to see, and the facts were somewhat irrelevant. So I think that's really sort of the sad outcome, which in many ways predicts what we've seen play out with this past election, where there really is kind of no meeting of the minds possible. People are in their corners and determined to stay there regardless of, you know, of the facts.
So that's so, you know, upsetting and kind of odd, really. So you're a reporter, and your job is to get out the facts. And the idea, I mean, I suppose this isn't new, but it does seem shocking with what's at stake. is that there are two camps, and people aren't looking at the facts as you're saying. They're sticking to their argument, their beliefs, regardless of the facts, which just seems like such a strange place to be. I mean, that's so regardless of the books, regardless of, I mean, it's happening now with the election, of course, regardless of the facts, Trump's saying, I won. What do you make of this? Do you feel like this has always been the case historically, or is this something that's new, that is a little bit of a kind of a Trumpism kind of thing, or, you know, a little bit like Orwell's 1984 too? Just say it and people will believe it. This kind of, again, sort of post-fact era that we're in. Is it post-fact? Has this always been the case, is what I'm asking, with these different camps of people not listening to the facts? Because I'm kind of curious where a reporter stands now in this kind of disturbing environment.
Well, I think it is difficult for a reporter because regardless of what we do, our role is cast as ideological on, you know, one way or another, which, you know, I think particularly as a Times reporter, I have really resisted. You know, my job is really just to find out information and not to take a position. But I think people have really confused that role over time. There were assumptions about our book made by people, you know, who hadn't read it at all. When it first came out, Trump tweeted about it, and both sides kind of weaponized it, and actually they hadn't, you know, read a page of it yet. And I do feel like this wasn't always the case. I mean, you had people, both Republicans and Democrats, appointing judges and justices in the past. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is one example where you had people voting for her from both ideological camps. And now it just feels as if the sides are too far apart. And unfortunately, you know, minds can't be changed, and there is no middle ground, which I do feel to some extent has been, if not prompted by the current president, certainly sanctioned by him with a more kind of pugilistic stance that he takes. And he has emboldened his followers to sort of argue the same, which is the sense that everything is, to some extent, a conspiracy, this idea of kind of the deep state, for example, or, you know, or kind of refusal to even negotiate on things or to kind of come a little bit closer, move off your position. I feel as if now there is this intransigence that is extremely widespread and somewhat celebrated. And it's clearly unfortunate because it results in things like not being able to get a new stimulus package because it's so much about Republicans versus Democrats that Americans are the ones who suffer.
Mm. Yeah, so true. I'm so glad that was written and that we're speaking about it a little bit. I want to talk about the art world and your involvement, of course, with it in New York. Is there anything else you want to mention about that book before we talk more about your articles and the Times? Again, it seems to me like such an important piece of reporting, but as you said, it's also been misconstrued by people who read one page of it or the back flap or something and assume that this is a kind of left takedown or something, right, of
right.
one of their idols. So, yeah,
I think, you know, in reality, I think that both sides were disappointed by the book because it didn't satisfy, you know, sort of either narrative that both either side wanted. I mean, on the one hand, what we set out to do was, and I think people wish that we had one way or another, you know, prove whether this guy is guilty. And I have done a number of kind of Me Too stories in my reporting for the Times, and I have found that typically when you have a perpetrator, there is a pattern of behavior that you see that doesn't take a whole lot to find. You know, you find one woman who's experienced harassment, there's usually several more right behind her. And that's not the case with Kavanaugh that we found. We really did investigate his past. And we found that both the stories of Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez from Yale were credible, that there was corroborating evidence in both cases that both of those women were not sort of politically motivated. But that said, we've also found that since college, basically, there was no pattern of behavior that continued into his adulthood. So either Brett Kavanaugh cleaned up his act, or those stories haven't yet surfaced, or, you know, perhaps he just grew up and became a more conscientious person, and that was youthful, you know, bad behavior that shouldn't be excused, but didn't necessarily continue. I think that's something a lot of people don't know. I think they also never really looked at his tenure on the court before he became he was up for a Supreme Court justice, and where he didn't really satisfy conservatives consistently or liberals. That, you know, he had a more complicated history. He also had a history of promoting women on the bench that may not have been known as well. So he had a more complicated story that our book does tell, and if people take the time to read it, I think they'll find that the picture is just not clear cut either way.
Right. Well, thank you for that. And to talk about the Times now, you've been doing a lot of reporting, and your a lot of articles have been about what's kind of happening in this really extraordinary year, which is museums are grappling with their board and their diversity and or lack thereof, and how it's changing. We could talk about a specific article, but do you feel like you're seeing a little bit of a sea change happening as museums are striving to change, or is this a kind of way of appeasing the public to some degree? Is change really happening, I guess, is what I'm asking. What are you seeing? You report on the boards of the Met and in other places making museums more diverse. What do you think about this process? Is it working?
I think that, you know, the real question is how meaningful the change is. I think
right.
that the reason that I think this might be a different moment is that in the past there has been a widespread recognition that diversity is a problem at these institutions at all levels. That means the boards are not diverse, the staff is not diverse, the artists they show in the case of the visual arts are not diverse. And there has been somewhat of kind of lip service paid to that. There's certainly been a recognition recently of kind of showing more Black artists that you see by both institutions as well as the art market. But I think that the Black Lives Matter movement has made kind of much more of a reckoning that is wholesale and different in the sense that it's kind of shaking these institutions to the core, forcing them to look at themselves in a much harsher way, and they're being called to account in a way that I think they realize will affect the health of their futures and their bottom line, frankly, that you cannot function as an institution in today's world without getting serious about these issues. And so you have, for example, boards, you know, I think really in earnest now trying to diversify their membership. You have certainly have the sense, which was already underway, that the whole canon needs to be revisited in terms of what kind of art is shown, given that it has been dominated by a white European tradition. But you also see that, you know, change can't happen unless there are staff members at galleries, auction houses, and museums who are influencing the conversation and have seats at the table. And so that's where some of this newer change, I think, is starting to happen in a way that hopefully will be lasting and meaningful.
I hope so. And, you know, I mean, to speak to one article, because I also interviewed Nancy Spector a while ago. That was kind of a reckoning there, a shakeup that kind of like Brett Kavanaugh seemed to be, unresolved. As chief curator, she was criticized for an atmosphere that was perhaps you know, racist or derogatory to a first-time black curator, but it seemed to end up kind of I don't want to say a draw, but that there that she left under circumstances that we don't understand exactly why. It seemed kind of like it was because of that, but it's hard to say. She had other projects, but it created that sort of gray area where what's happening? We don't really know what's happening there. It seems plausible that something like that could have happened. The woman who was, you know, asking for more information seemed clear enough. What do you think happened there? I mean, this is the kind of thing that seems to be repeating itself, but it often, you know, ends with a departure of somebody. Even like with all the, you know, movie stars in the Me Too, it just ended with these kind of departures, this kind of disappearance of who it was without understanding a little more what happened there. And so I guess what I'm getting at, I know you didn't write a book on this, but it almost seems like it could be like what really happened with the Guggenheim investigation. Were they really looking at things clearly? You know, how do we get to those facts is I guess my question of what really happened there and whether Nancy unwittingly or willingly really stepped over certain boundaries.
Well, I think that the interesting point about what's happened now is that the power has shifted just the way it happened in Me Too, where in the past you might have, let's say, had a woman complain about treatment by an employer, and ultimately the employer would survive, and the accuser would often find that the cost she paid was pretty high. Now, kind of the assumption of the belief is with those who are complaining. So it's sort of for the first time that there really is, it's kind of, you know, you're believing those who are speaking up from the bottom, and there is they have a voice in a way they didn't before that is taken more seriously and considered compelling. And perhaps there's been something of an overcorrection in the sense that they are getting the benefit of the doubt and those in power are kind of assumed to be at fault. And I think that in the case of Nancy Spector, as you say, you know, it is something of a gray area. We don't know exactly what transpired with that investigation. We do know that it concluded that she hadn't committed wrongdoing, and yet she is the one who departed. And so to some extent, one could argue that she was a casualty of that process. She certainly had more than 30 years of experience at the museum, and that's a kind of a lot of expertise to see go out the door. But I think there are others who would argue that there has been this systemic racism at a lot of institutions, and where it's being called out, it needs to be addressed. And if some people kind of are sort of collateral damage, so be it. And I think that might be the case here. And what, you know, you really see is the rank and file are kind of rising up in a way and actually having an impact. You see that with the unionization efforts at many museums, and you see it with staff members speaking out often by name about conduct they feel has been inappropriate for too long. And that's the moment we're in, and time is on their side now.
Right, which is really, you know, exciting. As much of a shakeup as this is to all the institutions, it seems like we're on a kind of a ground, and the art world should be a place to explore all this, where we're challenging all our assumptions. And I, of course, when I say our assumptions, I guess I'm talking about assumptions from groups of whites, predominantly white boards, and understanding ideas of systemic racism, which I think only a year ago would seem like something that was hard to approach or even manage or even take seriously, and now it's at the center of the table, isn't it? And so I guess what I'm kind of wondering is it getting to that point where it's a challenging time as you've written about to be a museum director, to be in this position facing all of these challenges, and at the same time, what is the role of kind of if I can use that phrase again, the kind of systemic racism that is trying to be addressed. And at the same time, this is often being addressed by people who are white and in power. Is that something that can work? You know what I mean? It's kind of like a critique of ourselves. It's different than having a black or a person or a museum director of color that's now faced with all these issues. They manage it differently. So I guess what I'm asking is just how do they even explore or find the facts in a situation where it may be hard to see outside ourselves? Can we really put that case right on the table? Is there a kind of, you know, myopia? Can white leaders really see that? That's not too odd a question.
Well, I think there is certainly a school of thought that feels like it's impossible for, you know, the white establishment to critique itself and change from within. That certainly exists out there, and you can speak to some kind of activist groups who have more of a burn it down mentality and approach, where it's not even worth saving these institutions because they have codified practices that they find problematic. I think, you know, on the other hand, realistically, that's probably not going to happen, and so you do have these white executives having to critique themselves, as you said. And since that's challenging, what they can do is bring people of color to the table and empower them to have a real say and a real voice, and so that it's not just optics, and it's not, these are not token efforts, but that they are making decisions, they are weighing in on matters that have to do with curating and have to do with leadership and governance, and have to do with, you know, management structure, and so that an institution really changes in a way that is kind of much more integral to the day-to-day of what it's like to work there. And I do believe that that has begun to happen, and there is a realization that you can't have sort of the usual suspects make meaningful change on their own. They need to bring others in who have different perspectives and have maybe different kinds of experience, but experience that's valuable. You can no longer use the excuse that it's hard to find black staff people, or let's say, or people of color, or that it's difficult to find people of color for the board. That's just not a sufficient argument anymore. You need to make more of an effort to go out and find them, to recruit them, as well as to develop them. You need to, you know, one of the main problems that we've identified in our reporting is the pipeline. For example, when it comes to curators of color, you know, a lot of the career trajectories start with unpaid internships, and people coming out of art school, if they've even been able to go to art school, often can't afford to take them. And right there you have kind of a roadblock, whereas kind of white, more privileged people can afford to take unpaid internships, and then suddenly you join this network that serves you for the rest of your career, making connections. People are going to help you along the way. All of that needs to change. You need to kind of fund scholarships at the schools that kind of in art history, and get more people who can have the kind of training that's required for these positions. But you can't accept that these are institutions that can operate as with business as usual. That's just no longer an acceptable kind of line of reasoning.
Right. Well, it's a strange and unusual and I guess exciting year in some ways with all of this change, all this activism. To step back from that a little bit, you've written a lot of articles about the arts in New York, and a lot of what we're talking about. And New York is such an incredibly vital and exciting place for the arts. What's your take on what's happening with the arts in the pandemic? Theater is out of New York. Museums and galleries are virtual. In terms of just the cultural landscape of New York, is it shifting, adjusting, changing over the last 6 months? It still seems, from what you're writing about, all these things are happening, but of course we're not seeing a lot of art, or certainly not in the same way. What's your sense of how the culture of New York is changing in terms of perhaps the visual arts, largely, and architecture?
I think it's really a difficult time right now, and I think that this pandemic is going to have lasting effects, unfortunately, particularly for a place like New York, which is so much about its cultural vitality and life. You have performances canceled, as you said, particularly for the performing arts. I think it's difficult. You have, you know, the dancers of New York City Ballet kind of having to raise money for themselves because they're not performing and they're really financially strapped. You have Broadway saying it's not back till the summer. And all of this has a ripple effect because that, you know, tourism shows no signs of coming back anytime soon. And there are so many ancillary businesses that suffer as a result, restaurants and hotels. So it's a real interconnected web, and I think one that unfortunately is going to take a real toll on that industry. In terms of museums, they've been a little bit of a bright spot because they were able to reopen after having to close. But they've had to do so at 25% capacity, and they were closed for several months. As it is, these are money-losing institutions. They can't really afford to ride out long periods with no revenue and no attendance. And so you saw the small ones really suffer, and some of them kind of come close to the brink. The larger ones are in better shape to weather that kind of a winter. But I think now you have this, with this resurgence of the virus, real questions about whether institutions are going to be able to stay open, even at a limited capacity. And there's real concern about the livelihood of these organizations, which are hand-to-mouth as it is. They depend on donors. They don't have a steady stream of support from government or corporations. They're constantly hustling to raise money. And I think a lot of them are worried about the future and their survival with good reason.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. And I hope they can, but we're of course talking about different types of institutions, right? Theater is one thing, and then there's museums, which are private, non-government funded, and then there's also all the galleries, which aren't nonprofits, or in that sector, and they're also struggling along the same way, right? That's a huge part of our culture too. That seems to be struggling as much, if not more, because of the lack of tourism and money and sales. And New York has an enormous amount of galleries.
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of this, of the economy. The galleries, some of them have been open by appointment, but certainly you're not going to see people strolling through Chelsea and doing any kind of a gallery crawl anytime soon. There is some movement to buying art online, but I don't think enough to compensate for the lack of in-person experience that galleries depend on. Auction houses are trying that as well with some success. And I think that we'll change the model to some degree where it is possible to buy art online, and people who were uncomfortable with that in the past may have grown more comfortable. But I do think that that this is, you know, you're going to see a ripple effect for some time to come in terms of how many levels of the field it affects. The only bright spot I would point to is perhaps that New York becomes more affordable for the kind of creative class. They had been sort of priced out in the past, and maybe now they will be able to afford to live there if prices come down on rents, for example. And, you know, in the past, you know, studio space obviously is really expensive. And so maybe New York is more hospitable to the artists. That, to me, kind of would be the only upside of all this.
Yeah, that is an upside. That's exactly what artists would like to see, because that's happened in so many cities where artists have been priced out and studios become impossible to afford. Robin, it's been great talking with you. I want to ask you one more question, the last question, which is, what are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious what everybody's reading.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of reading in COVID. Actually, I found that kind of one of the bright spots. I finally attempted and completed War and Peace, which was great. Mm-hmm. But I also have read some of the work that has been very much of our time, specifically Cast by Isabel Wilkerson, and How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. I also reading the novel A Burning, and I read the novel Monogamy by Sue Miller, and I plan to start Obama's book. I actually started it last night since it was just published yesterday, and I'm thinking maybe I will also listen to it because he reads it himself, and I think that might be a treat.
I think so too. Robin, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time and your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.